Hello, good afternoon. Thank you all for coming over to CSIS for this event. I'm Mark Sheff, Director of External Relations here at CSIS. I want to introduce our panel to you. You have short biographical sketches of each analyst in the media advisory that's available at the door, so I won't belabor each of their backgrounds. I'll just tell you that the people we have here are Robert Ebel, at my far right. He's chairman of the CSIS Energy Program. Next to Bob is Anthony Cordesman, CSIS Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy. In the middle, and right next to me, Frank Verastro, who's director of the CSIS Energy Program. Just as a housekeeping tip, you can get in touch directly with Bob, Tony, and Frank. We've, again, out front at the media sign-in, have this media information sheet, both sides. You'll find their numbers. So for follow-up questions, either on the OPEC meeting or any other issue that comes up that you're covering, feel free to contact them directly. So with that, we will start with an opening statement by Tony.
Let me make a very brief statement, and each of my colleagues is going to be talking in different ways about the oil market, so let me talk a little about the issue of stability and security. First, one of the realities is that from the viewpoint of somebody who looks at security analysis, some of what is happening is going to produce different conclusions than those of the people who are in the market. The last thing on earth you want in a complex international system is stability, predictable prices, and reliable supply. What you want is a system that forces the market to adapt, where prices go through cycles, where people realize the system is vulnerable, and where what happens is limited enough to force people to become adaptable, flexible, to improve their tracking and response theory. We do not face, at this point in time, any security crisis in supply. The problems, as my colleagues are going to outline, are different. And I think it is very dangerous to go from today's situation to the conclusion that all that is happening is something which in the long run or even medium term is not something that's a necessary aspect of how the oil market and the security system functions. That said, let me make a few comments about the patterns of security and terrorism. So far, we have not seen attacks in Saudi Arabia directed at oil facilities. We have seen a very clear pattern of attacks directed at the foreign presence in Saudi Arabia, at secular influences from the outside, at the kind of forces which, to the people in al-Qaeda, and much more to Salafi Islamists than to Wahhabis, are seen as the enemies of the kind of puritanical state that people would like to see created. Now, the Saudis have claimed that this situation is a relatively minor threat, that there were six cells and only one is active. I think it is fairly clear that that is far too optimistic. Nobody knows how many true supporters there are that are willing to use violence. We do know that somewhere between 7,500 and 15,000 Saudi young men went through various indoctrination centers and training camps between 1979 and today, and we know there are significant numbers in the kingdom. We know that up till really May of 2003, while the Saudis had focused on this threat, they had not given it the weight, the effort, and the seriousness that they should have. And as a result of what happened in 9/11, much of the focus shifted to dealing with political problems with the United States, the flow of money to foreign groups, and so on, rather than actually protecting Saudi facilities. After May 2003, that changed, and significant improvements began. but security capabilities take time to develop. And as they developed, the Saudis found that there were significant numbers of young men in Saudi Arabia that were allied at least loosely to Al-Qaeda, that there had been significant smuggling of arms and munitions across things like the Yemeni border, and that they were dealing with a very serious counterterrorism problem. Not a broad insurgency problem, but a counterterrorism problem. It is a fact that their system is very large, very broadly dispersed, that some of the bottlenecks in there could produce temporary cuts in output if they were attacked successfully. Attacking the system in ways which produce significant lasting interruptions are probably very difficult. You can postulate the attack. In some cases, it is technically possible. The reporting I have seen in the press so far has not done a particularly accurate job of identifying the targets, and if you'll forgive me, I'm not going to improve that today. But the fact is that in most of those targets that are real, there has been a significant increase in the security presence. But I think we need to count on it taking at least several years before you actually can bring this particular terrorist threat under control. And there are broad economic, social, and other reforms that have to take place in the kingdom to deal with the longer-term problems of stability. I'd make a couple of other points about the situation in the Middle East. One is that the situation in Iraq remains extremely unstable, and at this point in time, we will transfer power without any meaningful continuity by way of a plan for oil development and for oil recovery. Paper has been drafted, but paper does not consist of reality. So Iraq, at least in the near term, is not going to solve our problems, which is not to say that there will be major interruptions there. But certainly it is a fact of life that in many ways Iraq is still more vulnerable than Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states. Another point is there is no oil exporting state in the Middle East that does not have Islamist cadres and cells in it. The fact these attacks have occurred so far in Saudi Arabia is not a measure of the future. The problem is regional. And therefore, I think one question really for all of us is the extent to which you can refocus some aspects of the war on terrorism to look at energy security. Some of that has already occurred, and I'll be happy to deal with that in the question period, but it is not a major objective, at least as yet, of U.S. policy. And it is one which may have to be in the future, particularly because the Middle East is scarcely the only energy vulnerability issue. There are three others. In the short term, we have problems with Nigeria and Venezuela, which many of you are familiar with. In the longer run, one real question of what is coming out of this is, if you do not really deal with the problem of short-term terrorism, what impact does it have on mid- and long-term investment to increase oil production capabilities? And if we watch what's happening to date, the real impact in terms of terrorism might not be short-term interruptions or the things that have caused reactions in the oil market, but a cumulative impact on the infrastructure, investment, development of facilities in the Middle East, where even in the next few years, we expect enough increase in production to help deal with some of the squeezes that my colleagues are going to describe. So with that, let me turn it over to my colleagues.
Thank you. I'm Frank Barastro. I'm director of the Energy Program. We've got a slide presentation. We had to go upstairs and burn a disc because we didn't make enough hard copies for you, and here's the disc right now. So let me just make a few introductory comments. What you heard this morning, most of the press reports that we've seen at least initially, coming out of the OPEC meeting, was an increase of 2 million barrels a day. We think that's slightly misinterpreted, because what it really is legitimizing what the current production rates already are, which are in excess of 2 million barrels a day over the April quota. So until you start seeing new oil come into the market, and there's a question of how much new oil you need to balance supply and demand, and take into account the fact that it will take a certain amount of time to get shipments to the United States, especially get them into refineries, if they can take that crude to make gasoline, what impact that will have on price. So let me just kind of walk through. For those of you that's got handouts, just stand. For those of you that have handouts, you can follow it through. We just thought that since there's a lot of numbers here, it might be easier to go through if you have a visual. Taking a step back, just to look how we got in this position, you need to go back to the beginning of the year. And when OPEC went into their meeting in February, February 10th, what they were looking at was second quarter demand, as demand typically does in the spring as we come out of the winter heating season before we go into the gasoline driving season, demand goes down. The International Energy Agency had forecasted that we'd have a drop in demand of 2.5 million barrels a day from the first quarter down to about 77.4. Now, in the 5 months since that, it's been revised five times. The current estimate for second quarter demand is closer to 79 million barrels a day. So you can see that there's been a bump. But if you take that number as your target and you flip to the supply side, again, if you look over at the second quarter 2004 column, the projection for non-OPEC supply, and Bob will talk a little bit about that, was in excess of 50 million barrels a day. There's about 4 million barrels a day of natural gas liquids available. So if you're still shooting at a target of 77 or 78, the call on OPEC was estimated to be around 23. And that's presuming that Russia was going to increase production and people were concerned about Iraq ramping up, because at the beginning of the year, the projections for Iraq getting back to 2.8 by April were pretty significant. So what really happened? Well, second quarter demand were revised upward by about 1.3 million, and second quarter non-OPEC production has been revised downward by about 300,000 or 400,000 barrels a day. So you're getting a swing of between 1.5 million and 2 million barrels a day. We've had continuing problems, and Tony alluded to this, in Iraq, Venezuela, and Nigeria. And they've moderated what we thought OPEC increases would be. High gasoline demand in the United States has increased demand for lighter crudes, and I'll talk about quality and quantity because it's really both. We've had low inventory levels, and that's occasioned in part by the fact that we were underproducing at the beginning of the year and demand ramped up so quickly that a lot of the excess oil went right to the market, did not go into storage. We've had in the United States on the gasoline side changing product specifications, which has meant that refineries are working harder. We've banned MTBE in some of the larger markets, and now we have low sulfur requirements in gasoline that are coming on. So even our imports, the volume's been dropping a little bit because some of the import blends aren't able to meet U.S. specs. We also have market islands, and I'll talk a little bit about that, so that even if you have an additional supply in Pennsylvania, you might not be able to use it in Illinois because the gasoline specs are different. The threat of political instability and supply disruptions, this is kind of the fear factor. And as a result, even though Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the UAE have pledged additional volumes to the market, it doesn't change the dynamics of the speculation in terms of price. There's a lot of upside potential. There's a second question, and that's when you go back to the demand forecasts. If you look ahead to the fourth quarter and demand continues to increase, especially in North America and China, the call on OPEC will be increased, and when you look at productive capacity, you have to assume that nothing wrong will happen in the system to meet that demand, because that'll be between 82 and 83 million barrels a day. Here's a busy chart for you to look at. The two numbers you really have to focus on is the April quota number for the OPEC 10, which is 23.5. Today's announcement was that OPEC production for this month or going forward will be 25.5. Well, if you look at actual numbers in April, April production already exceeded the quota target. And the estimate for May, with additional Saudi oil and UAE oil coming on the market, is that they already exceeded the suspected quota or target price or target volume for August. So unless you're looking for incremental new volumes, what's in the marketplace is already there. Now, Saudi Arabia and UAE have pledged to increase production. We know that the Saudis in May had upped production to about 9 million barrels a day. But on an average monthly basis, it would probably bring the monthly volume on a daily basis, on an average basis, down to about 8.4, 8.5. So this is where your change has taken place in the market. The good news is that the incremental production that started in May is now working its way to U.S. markets. New production that's starting in June won't be here until the end of July in terms of factoring in for gasoline prices. This just shows you how capacity, because we're going to talk about capacity constraints. If you go back to 1979, OPEC's capacity was in excess of 38 million barrels a day. It's declined by over 7 million barrels a day. And the culprits are Iran, Iraq, and Libya, by and large. They account for 6 of the 7 million barrel a day drop, which shows what sanctions and war can do and how long it takes for a company or a country to come back. I'll skip this one. Prices, volatility. Tony just talked about the merits of price volatility. If you look over the last 30 years, it's been the rule, not the exception. And I think one of the things that OPEC has been concerned about is if you look at the Asian recession in the mid-1990s, is when they overshot the market. If prices get too high, like after the Iran-Iraq war, and during the Asian recession when demand went down, if there's an oversupply in the market, prices can drop precipitously. And the impact to these producer companies is considerable. These are OPEC net revenues between 1972 and 2005, projected for 2005, and the swing is tenfold, from $30 billion to $300 billion in nominal dollars. So imagine if you're a producing country deriving 90% of your budget from export revenues, what havoc that wreaks on your economy. In terms of OPEC oil revenues, since 1993, for most of these countries, it's doubled. For countries like Qatar, it's tripled. So that's substantial. What do you do with the revenue? And even in the case of Saudi Arabia, last year, you know, with prices in excess of $30 a barrel and producing a high volume, they ran a surplus for the first time in several years, not a deficit. The OPEC basket price. There's been a lot of discussion of the basket. For those of you who really believe that the basket price is still in the $22 to $28 range, we think it's more, you know, closer to 25 to 34 instead of 18 to 28. The challenges for OPEC, however, haven't really changed. Moderating prices in a high-demand market, because they are very concerned that if demand continues to grow and outpaces supply, that when you get to $40 and $45 a barrel, that you could have economic impacts. And every price increase leads to a demand downturn, or certainly has in the past. There's a threat, however, of demand reduction. You know, what if China craters? What if the demand numbers go back to being what we thought they would be on the low side? Then OPEC has oversupplied the market and prices could drop. There's a concern about the near-term erosion of market share by non-OPEC producers if Russia comes storming back, or we see increased production from Mexico or Angola or Canada. Managing the output from emerging members that have been constrained by quota. If there's new investment in Iraq, Libya, Nigeria, Iran, and they bump against their quota output but they're used to increasing revenues for their internal consumption, will they continue to stay as a member of OPEC? Technological advances, Venezuela, Canada, in terms of heavy oil and tar sands are something you need to be concerned about in the long term. Environmental concerns, and the immediate concern is the fear factor, sabotage, terrorism, and political instability. So now we'll switch to gasoline. The U.S. gasoline market, it's a problem of both crude quantity and quality. We need a lot of light crude for our refineries to make high gasoline yields. Demand has increased year over year in this country, especially coming out of last spring when it might have been depressed because of the war in Iraq. Refining capacity, while it's grown over the years, the number of refineries have gone down, but we may be reaching the limit on even expansion of existing refineries because of a population incursion more than anything else, and also environmental regulation. Low inventory, as we talked about, regulation and fuel specs has been a considerable concern to refineries. If they've spent a lot of money changing equipment to meet fuel specs, do they have additional billions to talk about expanding refinery capacity in this country? We'll talk about federal, state, and local taxes and the component part they make up in gasoline. And the security premium that's currently in the market ranges anywhere, depending on the estimates, between $5 and $12 a barrel. So this is current gasoline, and this is predicated on a gasoline price of between $2.04 and $2.13. I stopped changing this because it changes every day. Roughly speaking, for every dollar increase in the price of oil, it's reflected in about a 2.5 cent increase in gasoline. So you can compute $40, $42, what that means. But almost a third goes to taxes, federal, state, and local taxes. And California has the highest taxes in the nation. That's why they have the highest prices. But distribution, marketing, and reprocessing costs have also gone up, and profit margins have also increased during this period. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bob and talk about other productions.
Thank you, Frank. There are two countries that are thought to be standing in the wings, ready and willing to take the place of Saudi Arabia. And I'm going to talk in some detail about those two countries. First is Russia, and the second is Iraq. And I'll expand a bit on the comments that Tony offered on Iraq. Oil production in Russia today is matching that of Saudi Arabia. It's a little bit more than 9 million barrels of oil a day. So pretty close to what Saudi Arabia is producing. And I would guess that when the year comes to an end, that the average for 2004 for Russia will be about 9.1 million barrels of oil a day. Here's a country, though, where demand is relatively constant and has been for the last handful of years. And that means that most of the incremental barrels coming out of Russia today become available for export. Here, a country of 143 million people consume about 2.5 million barrels of oil every day. This year, production will go up by about 700,000 barrels per day. So you can translate most of that becoming available for export. I don't see much growth in demand this year. How does Russia feel about these high oil prices? It's a major exporter, probably will export about 6.5 million barrels of oil a day. So its budget is very much dependent, as are OPEC member countries, on the income from oil exports. They're going to maintain production growth this year, not in support of OPEC, not out of concern for the consumer. Let me quote the finance minister who made this statement very, very recently. It's in my handout. It said, annually, we increase production by 5 to 10%. We are going to maintain this momentum. The growth in oil production is planned regardless of price. Our strategy does not specify a reduction in prices should influence production. In other words, prices come down, we're going to continue to export just as much as we would when prices are high. We're going to increase production in accordance with our strategy. So a substantial price drop on the world oil market would not bring about a drop in Russian oil exports. Similarly, a increase in production in prices not going to bring about any sudden increase in production because they don't have that spare producing capacity. So they're going to continue to expand and to sell at whatever the price. That's really not any different than what the Soviet Union did. They sold whatever they had at whatever the price was. So they needed the money. But the question that comes forward today with regard to Russia is, can the growth in Russian oil production exports be maintained? Well, unfortunately, there are conflicting signals coming out of Moscow. And if we look hard enough, we can find official statements to support whatever answer we choose for that question. Can the production and exports be maintained? In effect, the Russian oil sector has been living off its inheritance. That is what it inherited from the former Soviet Union in terms of producing fields, pipelines, refineries, what have you. Has it been careful with this inheritance? Has it been spending it wisely? Or is it being depleted very quickly to take advantage of current high prices? Once again, we have some official statements that we can turn to. The country's energy regulator, that is the guy who monitors energy producers, had this to say. Growth in oil output is to stop in the year 2005 as some fields are being depleted. Lukoil, which is now the leading oil producer in Russia, had this to say. They noted that the annual production in Russia is to peak at between 9.6 and 10.3 million barrels a day as early as 2007 and then stabilized. So the question comes down to this. Where will the new oil come from? East Siberia, offshore, the Russian sector, the Caspian Sea. The potential is there. All it takes is time and money. A good portion of the money, though, is going to have to come from the pockets of the major international oil companies. And as time passes and as the older fields in Russia decline in terms of output, much of the new oil is going to have to go to offset that decline. On Iraq, here's a country of promises largely unfulfilled. Before the war, I had an opportunity to work with the Iraqi opposition in developing an assessment of its oil sector. In the minds of the Iraqi opposition, only Iraq had the potential to challenge Saudi Arabia as a producer and exporter. They said, well, look, Iraq is second only to Saudi Arabia in terms of reserves. We have a great number of oil fields that have been discovered but not yet developed. And much of the country remains untouched by the drill bit. So we think that maybe a production goal of around 6 million barrels of oil a day by the year 2000 is quite reasonable. And we have a longer range potential of 12 million barrels of oil a day. But there were others in the opposition that weren't so optimistic. They were thinking in terms of 4 to 4.5 million barrels a day by the end of this decade. So we should keep in mind that Iraq has never in its history produced more than 3.5 million barrels of oil a day. And that level was reached some 25 years ago. Moreover, any industry which has been neglected and underfunded for more than 20 years, bearing the impact of wars and 12 years of UN sanctions, any industry is going to suffer greatly. And the Iraqi oil sector is no exception. But it continues to struggle in its effort to return to at least pre-war levels of exports and production. It's getting close. Then it falls back as pipelines are taken out of operation because of sabotage or because just a breakdown in equipment. They hit their post-war peak in April at around 2.3 million barrels of oil a day, with exports about 1.9 million barrels of oil a day. And then they fell back because of sabotage. I would not think we can see much expansion in Iraq this year in terms of production and exports, and even into the year 2005. Time and money again come to the fore. Foreign investment is going to be essential if the oil sector is to move ahead. Iraqi oil is good quality. Production costs are low. There's easy access to ports of export. All these conditions are attractive to the foreign investor. But Iraq is well aware of this attraction, and the investment terms are not going to be so easy. When will a popularly elected, internationally recognized government be in place, ready to negotiate long-term investment contracts? And will contract terms, as well as the general conditions in the country, be acceptable to the potential investor? Only then will the investor be prepared to come to the negotiating table. Iraq today, as I said at the beginning, is one of promises unfulfilled. And the optimism, which was held early before the war, has now been replaced by a strong dose of reality. Let me make a final comment on what we've been talking about this morning. Saudi Arabia has something that no other country has. Russia doesn't have it, not today, not tomorrow. Iraq of the future is not going to have it. And that is substantial spare producing capacity to be used in support of its national interests. We as a country have searched long and far seeking a substitute for Persian Gulf oil. The continuing centerpiece of our energy policy has been to encourage U.S. oil companies to explore for oil outside the United States but away from the Persian Gulf. This effort in some ways has been somewhat encouraging. Caspian oil, West African oil, Russian oil, all helpful to the importer as he seeks security of supply through diversity of supply. but production follows reserves. And where are the bulk of oil reserves? In the Gulf. So I think we can, at least I can conclude, that there is no substitute for Saudi oil. Not yesterday, not today, not tomorrow. Thank you.
We're happy to entertain questions now. Just two quick housekeeping things. For those of you who didn't get a copy of Frank's presentation, we now have more copies available outside when you leave. And we also have outside a statement from Luis Giusti, who's a senior advisor in the CSIS Energy Program. He is the former head of the Venezuelan State Oil Company and is now with us here at CSIS. So we'll start the Q&A, and I apologize that you over here don't have a full-on view of Frank, but anyway, about as far back as I can go at the podium. So we'll take questions. Yes?
Warren B., LA Times. Does $40 oil endanger the U.S. economy?
We haven't seen a decrease in demand yet, at least on the consumption side. If you, in the past, every time we've had prices that have been sustained over $35 a barrel for 4 months, 5 months, it's led to an economic recession. Our GDP has been unconnected from oil prices. We're more efficient than we were in the 70s, but sustained prices in excess of $40 or $45 a barrel certainly has a dampening effect, whether it's in gasoline consumption or it translates through the economy to things that you buy that are moved by truck or by rail or by airline. So, yeah, it's a concern.
I would just add the point. The one answer to your question is when. In the short term, certainly. But if the U.S. economy assumes that oil prices are predictable within the basket and structurally adapts to stable oil prices, then in any mid- or long-term sense, having stable prices creates, again, this climate of illusion, which simply is not going to occur in the future. Again, the problem here is that these cycles of instability at low levels have a productive impact as well as a negative one.
And I'd ask that everyone do what Warren did. Please identify yourself and your organization. Yes, right here.
So Jim, I'm stopping here with Bloomberg News. Two questions for Mr. Korsman. Is it your view that the Saudis have honestly faced up to the internal threats that exist and have taken effective measures to deal with them over this past year? And I'd also like to ask, what should the U.S. do to, as you say, refocus the war on terrorism to deal with energy security issues?
Well, first, I think the Saudis have, since May 2003, faced up to the scale of the internal threat. There are no instant solutions to counter terrorism. You don't create real-world capabilities simply by recruiting more people, buying more equipment, and putting more guards in the field. It's hard to get long lead time items, buy redundancy, think about ways of reducing vulnerability. That, and then the question is where? Do you do it domestically in the oil industry? So I think the honest answer to your question is, have they faced up to the threat and the problems they face? Yes. Can they adapt to it? Probably. But it's going to take some time. Do they tend to understate the threat? Well, virtually everybody who has a threat does. But you need to look back at this. First, Israel is probably the most experienced country in the world in dealing with counterterrorism. Is it perfect? No. Have the British, who probably rank second, ever been able to secure Northern Ireland? No, they haven't. When Europe was facing tiny threats from Baader Meinhof and the Red Brigades, it took 3 to 5 years to counter them when we were talking cells that couldn't replete or strengthen themselves over time. And a lot of the judgments that people are making about how quickly you can do this defy historical reality. Now, how do you deal with this? Well, precisely because of this, the Saudis and others in the Gulf need as much U.S. and other help in counterterrorism, training, equipment, intelligence, outside support teams as they can absorb and are willing to take. They need the kind of pressure they have had from the United States to improve things, and they've had it from Britain, France, and other countries as well. One of the broader issues is that we have never designed energy facilities in the Gulf to deal in broad terms with the threat of terrorism. There are many areas where people went for economies of scale or created bottlenecks which should probably be removed so you do not have easy targets and you have a more stable system. And since we project massive increases in the flow of exports over the next 5, 10, and 15 years, and we are going to watch problems in terms of demographics, internal instability, economics, and so on play out over at least the next 20, one key issue is how do we work with exporters in this region to create a more stable growth and redesign of the systems over time to make them less vulnerable and more reliable.
Yes.
Barry, account for Toronto Globe Mail. Mr. Korsman, you mentioned that it would take several years to deal with the terrorist threat in Saudi Arabia. Does that mean that the fear factor created in Toronto oil now will remain for several years?
Well, I'd leave part of this to my colleagues, but it is a reality in economics and particularly in commodity markets. Whenever anything goes wrong, people tend to have a higher fear premium than is really sustainable over time. We just can't make that prediction. If they continue only to attack foreign workers, then I think the premium will go down significantly. If the Saudis roll up more of the cells, it will go down. The first time anybody hits an energy facility anywhere in the Gulf, the fear premium will probably be very high. And as Frank pointed out, these are very unstable, volatile prices. But one other aspect of this, as the market learns that you don't get the worst case, the Cassandra model, that there aren't the Saudi equivalents of Dr. No out there capable of destroying the whole system with a hand grenade, then people become less and less sensitive to each attack and the fear premium tends to go down. But is this a volatile situation? Of course it is.
Yes.
Dick Farmer, Congressional Budget Office. On that last point, if U.S. oil workers in particular heed the State Department warnings, can the Saudis increase production as they're planning or even would they be able to sustain it?
I don't think the problem is oil workers. Out of the current Aramco structure, if you get rid of Americans, you're probably going to find there are plenty of people outside who can be recruited, handle a lot of the technical chores that are left, and may actually be cheaper for Saudi Arabia. A lot of this is to some extent a political heritage of Aramco's origins. It will, I think, have much more impact on Saudi Arabia's ability to develop its gas industry, which, of course, affects how much oil it can export. It will affect Saudi Arabia's ability to bring in advanced technology, to go into downstream operations, and certainly to attract foreign investment. All of those things will impact sooner or later on what the kingdom can do in terms of investing in crude oil, as well as in other areas of its development. And so certainly if you watch this situation dealt with as it's been to date, and I have to say I think the U.S. Embassy dealt with it more in terms of panic than anything else, although frankly having worked in the State Department, the tendency to use a kind of cover-your-ass warning notice every time anything goes wrong in any country is so ubiquitous, I can't blame the embassy in Saudi Arabia. But yes, if people really react to this kind of warning and panic along with the embassy, the results could be quite serious.
Let me just add to that. Having been to Saudi Arabia 2 months ago, Saudi Aramco personnel are much better served than they were, say, 10 years ago in terms of indigenous people running the facilities and the operations. There's still a number of expats, but a lot of them are there because they want to be there. I don't know that it affects the technical capability of Saudi Aramco in any way.
And this is Wabah. Could you comment, or from anyone else, on what effect you think today's OPEC's decision to raise the quota by 2 million barrels, I think July 1st, and then 500,000, another 500,000 August 1st, is going to have, maybe not just for the summer, but also the upcoming winter, which in terms of
And that's a good question because, with demand much higher in the fourth quarter than what it is today, will there be sufficient oil to meet that demand? The high oil prices today, in large part, are demand-driven. Can we look forward to a time when high oil prices will be supply-driven? That's a rather short answer to your question. But I think there is concern about the fourth quarter. But in the interim, between now and then, Saudi Arabia will be concerned about, will supply overwhelm demand during the summertime and early fall. But as we get into the fourth quarter, I think the concern shifts around. Will we have enough oil to meet the growing demand? At least in my judgment.
My name is Mike Niazawa. What do you think is the impact, either direct or indirect, of the resignation today of George Tenet on the oil market and counterterrorism?
Let me say that I think it is inevitable in the next day George Tenet is going to be tried in the media and tried by rumor. He already is, if you read the wire services. But I think first he has been seen within the agency as an outstanding director. The problems he faced, I think, would have been faced by any director. They are not related to the current war on terrorism. They are not related to petroleum. They are not related to oil supplies. His resignation is not going to affect any function of the U.S. intelligence community or any function of the U.S. counterterrorist efforts or any other aspect of U.S. security efforts, and it certainly isn't going to affect energy planning. Now, again, as I said, my experience is that anything like this tends to produce some reaction in the stock market and in the commodity market. And so my advice would frankly to be to go out and speculate that there will be a temporary rise in prices and try to make your million while you can. But I do not see that this is any reason to overreact in any way, and I think that while all of us make mistakes, and I'm sure that Director Tenet did, I would at least take into account, as you see the speculation in the media that's going to occur, how respected he became within the CIA and within the intelligence community.
Yes. Stephanie Collins, Bureau of National Affairs. Two more questions. What effect, do you think, on the price of oil is the fact that the United States, China, and other countries are trying to stockpile oil reserves? And then secondly, what effect on the price of oil is market speculation playing into all of this? If that eases off, could we see the price of oil come down significantly?
Well, we're adding about, a little over 100,000 barrels of oil a day to our strategic petroleum reserve. If you put that oil out into the marketplace and you refined it, and that would give you about 45,000 barrels of oil a day of gasoline against a daily demand of in excess of 9 million barrels, what kind of impact would that have on the price? Not much. Yeah, we're watching China very closely because this is where the real push in demand is coming from, world oil demand. In fact, if you go back to the year 1990 and take it up to the present time, almost 70% of the growth in world oil demand has taken place in the Asia-Pacific regions. That is largely China, Japan, Korea, and India. So we watch those countries very closely. Suppose something happens to demand in China caused by not necessarily a soft landing of the economy, but maybe a hard landing where demand collapses. And if demand collapses in China, world oil demand growth goes down. OPEC's been through that back in the 1990s, and they don't want to make the mistake again of having too much oil out in the marketplace when something happens to demand. China's trying to develop its own strategic petroleum reserve, has selected four sites. But I think they're toying with the question, do we go ahead and build the sites but not fill them until the price comes down? Or do we try to fill them at a time when price is so high? So it's a real question that they face. They have to have the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. We have long encouraged them to do just that, but it's been slow in coming. But it's, you know, expensive oil for China could have a way of slowing things down. They're not, you know, they're worried very much now about security of supply, just as most that all the importing countries are. Here's a country that until 1993 was not a net importer, it was a net exporter. Now things are different, and they're out exposed in the world oil market just like everybody else.
Chad, there's a psychological piece to the SPR as well, and there's two separate questions. One is suspending the fill rate, and the other is actually drawing down. And I agree with Bob in terms of the actual price effect from additional gasoline or additional oil to be put on the market. It just strikes me on the building up the reserve at this point. It's not only high-priced oil, but at a time when we're asking other producers around the world to ante up and produce another 150,000 barrels a day, because that's significant in the accumulation part of it, to be taking that much off the market and putting it in reserve doesn't make a lot of sense. And at 100,000 barrels a day, it'll take over 6 months. If you suspended the fill rate for 6 months, you would have gained less than a day's worth of additional security. So in the short term, if you're concerned about getting through the driving season, continuing to fill the reserve at this point, it doesn't make a lot of economic sense.
There's another aspect of that question. Well, instead of filling, why don't we start withdrawing? Why don't we do at least a test withdrawal of 5 million barrels and see what happens? What psychological impact would this have on the marketplace? Would this lead people to think that we're getting ready to make major continuous withdrawals from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? Possibly. But if I were an oil exporter, I would say, oh, they're getting ready to withdraw from the SPR. I don't need to expand production because they're taking care of it themselves. So you could end up with no change in the world oil balance.
I'm Yakhtar from the World Bank. Just to follow up to this, I just came back from China. I was there last week. And just last week, they announced new discoveries in the Northwest of about 3 billion barrels. That was an initial discovery. And they anticipate that there will be, there will be much more reserves. Secondly, it seems like gasoline is highly subsidized in China, but it's sold at about 40 cents a liter. So, at the medium term, what would be the impact of these discoveries and possibly larger discoveries in I'm speaking about China.
Right, okay.
And future changes in pricing, realistic of downstream products.
Okay, well, you know, that new discovery has been touted as the largest oil discovery in China in the past decade. Well, it's probably the only major discovery that they made in the last decade. And here, the major oil field in China, Dacheng, you know, is what you're doing now is calculating its decline on an annual basis. So by the time this new discovery comes into play, whenever that might be, seven, 8 years from now, where will Dacheng be? Well, on balance, probably the new oil will no more than offset what Dacheng, you know, had lost. So, well, it's helpful. If you are subsidizing gasoline, maybe the Chinese are, you know, become so accustomed to cheap gasoline that is it politically doable to raise prices in a way of causing the consumer to conserve? What impact would that have on the market? What would the impact have on the individual consumer? You might be able to get away with slight increases every year. But maybe China's like the United States. You know, you can't even get an increase in the tax of a nickel a gallon, you know, without causing all sorts of political fallout. I'm sure they've looked at it, and they're talking about conservation in China. give the people an incentive to conserve. An incentive comes in price.
You know, yeah.
When
you asked that question, I was in Western China about 2 years ago talking to people about the aftermath of their last massive discovery of oil reserves, which, of course, turned out not to be a discovery at all. I hope this one is, shall we say, a great deal better grounded in reality than some previous Chinese discovery of reserves have been. But you hit on something that this price subsidy issue, which reminded me of the situation in Iraq. We not only, as Bob said, do not have any clear development plan, and it is compounded by all of the debates between Shiite and Sunni and Kurd and Turkmen and Arab. But one of the heritages of the CPA is we sustained oil prices at 4 to 5 cents a gallon in Iraq as the street price of gasoline, for which we are paying somewhere between $1.70 to $2 a gallon in the U.S. The end result is that we have created an incredible increase in domestic consumption in Iraq for, in the near term, refined product and obviously for crude as well. So if you want to look at really bad oil subsidy policies, the one that the CPA adopted in Iraq has to set the record. And it is, I think, truly ironic that having gone in there to try to create a market system, we managed to distort the market just about as badly in energy as anybody could conceivably do it.
Let me just add one other point. Going back to the time it takes to develop a field, if you look at the Caspian and the AIOC project was similar in size, 3 to 4 billion barrels. We're 10 years out from the signing of the contract, and production is 150,000 barrels a day or less. So it takes a good long time to ramp up.
Paul from the Washington Post. I want to come back to you, Mr. Barrasso. You can also take a crack at this question. What does today's decision portend for prices over the next, in the short and convenient term? You said that the increase only validates what's already being produced. But then, I mean, can you spin that forward a bit and talk about what?
Yeah, I think there's two separate things. In terms of extra oil being put on the market, when it's delivered to the United States, so we'll start seeing this in the next 4 to 6 weeks, stuff that's already been produced and has been on the market in May should start showing up. To the extent that it meets demand and it can be made into products that are usable, prices can be moderated. What it doesn't do is deal with the fear factor that both Bob and Tony talked about. Nothing has changed since the events over the weekend or the events 2 weeks ago. We could have more volume on the market, but if the market is tight, any disruption, whether it's Venezuela, Nigeria, Iraq, or Saudi Arabia, is going to give speculators an advantage in that the potential is on the upside. And so far, they haven't been wrong. There's a greater likelihood of prices increasing than decreasing in the short term.
Does that answer your question?
So in the short term, while markets are tight, which is basically the sum.
Mm-hmm.
We assume, I guess, that markets will not be quite so tight in the fall. Right? After the
gasoline demand should go down a bit after Labor Day, right?
So at that point, fundamentals will begin to reassert themselves.
Assuming that increased production adds to the supply, and even if it's in excess of demand, we're going to put some oil in storage because the fourth quarter issue that Bob brought up, I think it's very real. At current production limits today, if nothing else goes wrong and non-OPEC stays at 50 and OPEC can produce, including Iraq, at about 28, we ought to have enough oil in the fall and in the fourth quarter. But if anything else changes that dynamic, if Iraq can't produce because there's sabotage to the pipelines, if Nigeria or Venezuela go down, if there's a disruption in Saudi Arabia, then you're going to still, even in the fall, have a price impact. And the security premium is still going to be there because nothing has changed in that regard.
There's one other impact historically. We don't know whether it will occur again. That is elasticity is not the same in all countries. At a given point, if prices rise to it, developing countries simply can no longer afford to compete. and they tend to drop out of the market disproportionately quickly rather than having some smooth elasticity curve. We don't know how much that price rise, which has not produced reductions in Asian growth or Western growth, has already affected the poorer developing countries. There's simply no way to track it. But the last few times this has happened, it does have a disproportionate impact on poorer countries.
Just to come back again,
you said well, that's three times, Mark.
That the price band is now in 28-35.
Yeah, 24-34, something there.
24-34?
Yeah, it's just not the 22-28 anymore, I don't think.
Okay. So in other words, you're saying that even if everything goes, even if there are not disruptions, mm-hmm. no major terrorism in Venezuela the best scenario is you're still in the. I mean, I don't understand if I'm interpreting this correctly.
No, I think you are.
I mean, if you think it's completely crazy to venture any kind of prediction about prices, I understand that. But did I understand you correctly that your sort of best case is still in the.
I'm saying if you go back and look, not just in the immediate past, but you go back 5 years, we've had, I think, kind of bracket creep. So that prices have gone, this idea that we had a bracket price, I think it's higher than the expectation of what it was. And market fundamentals show that it should probably be in the high 20s, low 30s, and that anything above that is probably a security premium. And I've seen numbers from $5 to $12, depending on near-term, short-term, what do you think is going to happen. If market fundamentals change, if China's demand goes down, and OPEC is oversupplying the market, it takes a while. You've seen the charts, even going back 30 years, that we've had volatility in the oil marketplace. It doesn't take a lot in terms of overproduction or underproduction because it's the marginal barrel that drives the train here. So I think in going forward, you still have volatility unless you bring a lot more production on or we get more stable demand.
We have time for about two more questions, Tom.
What happens if this latest effort by OPEC or the Saudis, really in particular, to increase production does not work? The fear factor remains there. Prices remain high because while they are supplying more oil, the market is worried, well, they might not get here because of some kind of attack. Are we then, therefore, at a point where the U.S. or the only other big reliable supply of oil that is secure is the SPR, and maybe the government should do a 5 million barrel test cell to prove we are ready to use it if we have to? Because right now the administration doesn't say they're considering it. It's like, unless there's an oil embargo, we're not going to touch it. At what point does it make sense to do a test cell maybe or consider suspensions of the SPR, deliveries to the SPR?
I think that there's two separate issues here. One is the issue of speculators and price and what's driving in the market. The other is using the SPR to offset an actual shortfall. If something were to happen, if there was sabotage or a pipeline is blown up or a loading facility is blown up, that's the point that you would actually need the SPR because there's no other substitute. If it's Saudi Arabia, for example, the rest of the world can't fill that gap. So that's what you'd use the SPR for. If you're talking about price, I think people are waiting to see, and it hasn't really changed in terms of gasoline consumption, but they're waiting to see what the next couple of months mean. Will high prices, as Tony suggested, start reducing demand in some of the poorer countries? Will China continue to keep growing? Will U.S. gasoline demand be offset a bit because people at the pump are not willing to pay, $2.25 anymore? So OPEC is doing, I think, what you would expect OPEC to do as a prudent business decision. You kind of look at the market, you put out what you think is needed, you don't want to oversupply, and you reevaluate in 60 days or 30 days. In the meantime, as long as prices stay high, my gut reaction is the same as what they've been doing for the last couple of months. Those that have additional production will cheat on their quota. If you can sell your oil for $35 or $37 a barrel and you have another barrel to sell, with the exception of Saudi Arabia, that probably won't go all the way to the limit, almost everyone else is at capacity or will be at capacity.
One important point about the SPR, it is designed to deal with interruptions, not structural changes in the oil market. it does not make sense to draw down on the SPR if you anticipate years of, say, low-level terrorism or risk from Al-Qaeda in the Middle East. It simply is not what it is designed to do, and you would simply be wasting oil, which could be extremely valuable in a critical situation. If you have a long-term risk premium, what you do is you adapt to it. You live with it. And if that affects economic growth or conservation or supply in other areas, that's a fact of life. But it's not something the SBR should be used to deal with.
So the economy would have to suffer. It is okay if it means we have a secure emergency supply.
What I'm saying is you will not solve any problem by taking a limited amount of oil out of the SBR and trying to change the structural nature of the world oil market. As Bob pointed out, all that does basically is waste the SBR in a contingency for which it was never designed. There are people politically who might want to see oil prices capped before the election. That is not in the national interest.
Kathy Lander with Platts. You mentioned early on in the presentation that it isn't just the quantity of oil that's coming on the market, but also the quality. With Saudi Arabia being the only real country able to make real production increases and most of their crude being sour, what effect does that have on the U.S. market, particularly for gasoline?
The 2 points again. I think the Saudis believe that the market is already adequately supplied, but they're willing to produce more to make sure that there's a cushion. You're starting to see refinery spreads, and you can look in the first quarter and see profit margins of refiners. Those that have the capability of buying lower quality crude and still selling gasoline at the market price are making good-sized profits. What's happening is there's somewhat of a shift, and it's really dependent on the capability of the refinery and the crude oil that's available. But the light sweet stuff is the easiest to make a high gasoline yield out of, but it's also you pay a premium for it. If you can run something less expensive and run your equipment harder, you're probably doing that and making a bigger profit margin. So the addition of additional barrels on the market has some effect, not a large effect. I think EIA put out a report the other day that suggested that if refineries, for example, were able to increase utilization rates from 96 to 98%, which they've done in the past, that that's an extra 350,000 barrels a day of throughput, which translates into an additional 160,000 barrels a day of gasoline, if you assume about 50% gasoline yield. And if you add that up over time, that's 5 million barrels a month. So that there's other ways of approaching this, if you think. But again, if you're a refiner, you kind of look at these blips and anomalies, and when do they become a trend? And the tendency in this country is to meet certain requirements, like sulfur specs and fuel additives, to be able to deliver product. You're probably not going to make investment in new capacity unless you think that demand is sustainable. So what we've done in the past is increased our imports, but we may be getting to a limit there.
Well, we have to wrap up there. Thank you all for coming over this afternoon.